In Pakistani headlines, you'll often see mentions of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The World Bank continuously releases figures on Pakistan's economy, poverty rate, and various social indicators, and even plays an important diplomatic role by mediating the Indus Waters Treaty between Pakistan and India. We've also seen much talk about the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF for short, after it completed its stabilization program in September to keep Pakistan's economy above water. So the World Bank and the IMF are arguably and historically the two most important multilateral development banks, which support low-income countries for projects in energy, education, industry, infrastructure, and a whole lot of other sectors to stimulate economic growth and raise living standards. But although we often hear about them, how do they perform that enormous task of global development? And has it worked? Welcome to Talking Ideas. I'm Sherry Arnabi. In this episode, I sat down with Masood Ahmed to talk about multilateral development organizations. Masood Ahmed is the incoming president of the Center for Global Development, a leading think tank on development policy issues based in Washington, D.C. He's also a veteran of the multilaterals, with nearly four decades of experience working at the World Bank, the IMF, and the United Kingdom's Department for International Development. He gave us his thoughts on, among other topics, the effects of globalization, the IMF's economic stabilization program in Pakistan, and what the strengths and limitations of development institutions are when it comes to having a real impact.
What the rest of the world, what international institutions can do, is to support those people who want to bring about change, empower them through their knowledge, experience, and know-how, but they cannot substitute themselves for the change drivers and policy makers from within countries.
Masood Ahmed, thank you so much for coming on Talking Ideas. So I recently went to a little seminar, a book talk, at the Center for Global Development. And basically it was a book about looking at the issue of whether rich nations should help the global poor. There were interesting takes on it. You know, overwhelmingly it was saying, you know, yes, they should. And here are sort of the moral and, you know, pragmatic reasons why they should. So I just wanted to know what's your take on it? What's the justification for, you know, rich countries where a lot of these multilateral development institutions are located? What's the justification for them to help the global poor?
Well, I would say that there are three kinds of reasons why it makes sense for not just rich countries, but people in general who live in parts of the world where there's more economic development to worry about those who live in less fortunate circumstances and to find ways to help them. The first one is the one you mentioned. I think there is a basic moral imperative. We all are fortunate in some ways to have had opportunities that others haven't. And I think if you believe in any kind of moral compass, it just seems the right thing to do. But beyond that, second set of reasons is that it's often in the interest of people in the rich countries to see a more prosperous and more stable neighborhood around them and then more broadly around the world. And if you think about the world today, what you see is that increasingly we're interconnected. We've always been interconnected in ways, but what happens now in Africa, what will happen in Africa over the next decade as population increases by over a billion people in sub-Saharan Africa, will have a huge impact on Europe, will have a huge impact on the rest of the world. What happens in the Middle East spills over into the rest of the world in good ways and bad. So I think there is increasingly through the interconnections that we have, through trade, through technology, through remittances, through all kinds of financial transactions, that makes it important for us to see a better neighborhood. Finally, I would say that I think perhaps more and more this is no longer an issue of rich countries and poor countries, but thinking about people as the center of our development paradigm. If you start thinking about people, then you realize that there are poor people in countries that are middle income, and there are some very rich people in very poor countries. So I think increasingly we have to start looking at ways in which individually and collectively we find ways in which we can allow people around the world who currently are held back from realizing their full potential to be able to break those barriers and take advantage of everything that the world has to offer.
What would you say to someone who, you know, is a globalization skeptic or is a skeptic of the benefits of integration? You know, someone who puts their country's needs first. What's the case to be made for them?
I would say that the first thing to recognize is that globalization or greater trade, for example, has delivered huge gains to people in every country. So it's not just a question of saying that some countries have benefited from globalization, others have not. Now, why is it that today there are so many people who are skeptical about globalization? And I would say there are two reasons for that. One is that they feel that although other people in their own country may have benefited from free trade, from greater movement of capital, that in the process they have been left behind. Either their relative position hasn't improved, or even sometimes their absolute living standards haven't improved. In the United States, for example, there are significant chunks of people whose living standards have not improved over the last decade, over the last 15 years, they find that more and more they are finding it harder to compete because they don't have the right skill set. So that's one very practical, personal reason for some people. Another reason is that often people think that the problems they're having are due to globalization, when the causes may be quite different, because all the analysis that has been done of why people's relative incomes have changed, why inequality has gone up so much over the last two decades, shows that technology is as important a driver as is globalization. So sometimes it's easier to blame or identify your problems with a phenomenon that somehow puts some other group at the end of it. But actually it's how technology is altering the production process and therefore also the kinds of skills that people need to be able to compete today in the world. So that creates a degree of anxiety, a degree of resentment, a degree of frustration. Now, what is our answer to people like that? I think the first thing is that we have to acknowledge that there are people who have been left behind. And I do feel that as a global community, some of us have not adequately recognize that there are people everywhere who feel that the process of integration is moving very fast, and they feel they're losing control over their own lives, that their own identities are being threatened in some ways. We have to acknowledge that, but then we have also got to explain much better than we've sometimes been able to do as to how they and others in the same group have benefited also from trade and from the opportunity to be able to participate in a bigger market. And then finally, I think we have to recognize and focus our efforts on accelerating the training and retraining that people need to be able to compete better in the changing marketplace of today.
Going to the role that, you know, multilateral development organizations and development banks have to play, such as the International Monetary Fund, such as the World Bank, both of which you've worked at. So how would you define their role, and how do you think their role has sort of changed or evolved over time?
Well, of course, they all have slightly different roles, but fundamentally, all of these institutions bring about three kinds of contributions. One is that they can help through the transfer of technology and experience from the broad membership that is that they have. So if you're trying to build a dam in Africa, or if you're trying to improve your school system in Pakistan, or if you're trying to deal with the banking crisis in Eastern Europe, then these institutions can bring to bear the experience and knowledge that comes from looking at how these similar issues have been addressed in other parts of the world and what lessons can be drawn from them. So I think that's a very basic role that they bring. A second role that they have is to actually help strengthen capacity, institutional capacity, in their member countries. So, for example, if you are trying to strengthen the management of public debt in the Ministry of Finance in any country, you can actually get technical experts from the World Bank or from the IMF or from regional development banks who can come and work with you to help you on your journey to strengthen the institutional capacity there. And then a final role they have is to provide financing. And financing they can provide because there is an advantage in pooling the risks that comes from all of the countries together being members of an institution. It's a bit like a cooperative. So the World Bank, for example, lends mainly to countries that are not as creditworthy as some other countries, but itself it is able to borrow in the market at very creditworthy, very low spreads, AAA rates. Why is it able to borrow at a better rate than any of its borrowers? Because markets recognize that because it is a cooperative collective, the pooling of risks makes it a much better risk for financiers, and also because the members who are the most creditworthy countries, generally the richest countries, stand behind it even though they don't borrow from it. So there's an ability to mobilize capital. Now, if you look at the IMF is a different kind of role on financing. The IMF provides financing to countries. Again, it's a cooperative. The money that they have is money that is provided by their 189 member countries. So that money they're able to lend to one of their members who happens to be going through a difficult financial crisis. So they may have balance of payments problem, they have banking crisis. This means that they need some short-term financing to help ease the process of adjusting to that crisis. They obviously have to take some steps to adjust to the crisis, but the financing helps to make it a bit easier to make that adjustment. The IMF can provide the financing often at the times when the markets are not willing to provide financing because precisely the country is going through a difficult patch. So that's the financing role. Now, the institutions have evolved over the years. They have learned lessons from their own experience. Our understanding of how societies develop and change has grown enormously over the last 50 years. Our understanding of how you can influence change in societies, and also the limits of how much you can influence change from the outside in societies, has also grown over the last 50 years. So I think what these institutions do today, whether it's the World Bank, whether it's regional banks, or whether it's the IMF, benefits from the accumulated experience and is in many ways much more adapted to the to what works in the development support process than would have been the case 20, 30, or 40 years ago.
What would you identify as some of the probably the greatest successes of these organizations, or the greatest successes that you've seen while working there?
Well, I think if you go back, you know, one of the early days of the World Bank, a big success was to be able to mobilize the technical skills, the medical skills, and the financing and organization to be able to help countries in Africa deal with river blindness. If you go into the lobby of the World Bank headquarters, you will see a statue of a man, a blind man, being led by a small boy. And that statue commemorates the contribution that the global community at that time, led by the World Bank, made to eradicating, or at least mostly eradicating, river blindness. River blindness was a problem that affected many, many villages in Africa, where because the water had a particular kind of worm in it, and that parasite would cause people to go blind, often in their prime. And then they would spend the rest of their life blind themselves and often a burden on their families and on society, being led about by young children because they couldn't see where they were going. So being able to eradicate that was one very good example of how the World Bank could mobilize and catalyze some tangible improvement in the lives of people in not just one country, but many. Another example I'd give you is the role that came much later when the World Bank and the IMF both recognized that the approach that they had had to helping countries wasn't really putting countries themselves at the center of the decision-making process. That they were often arriving with solutions or with proposals that reflected good technical understanding of the problem at hand, but didn't take into account the precise sociological and societal structures of the countries in which they were working. Around the end of the 1990s, they came up with a new approach to help countries, particularly low-income countries, which required the assistance that they and others provided to be structured around a country-led poverty reduction strategy, which put poverty reduction at the center of the process, made the countries develop their own strategy as the heart of the way to deal with the poverty reduction agenda, and then organize the support that the World Bank and others had in support of that agenda. And it also required that when countries came up with their own strategy, they did so through a broad process of consultation, because it became clear at the time that not just as the World Bank, the IMF, the African Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Latin American Bank, Development Bank, just as these institutions could not understand all of the dynamics and underlying constraints structures in countries, so also governments were only part of the solution. They could also only understand part of it. And you had to bring in the broad spectrum of society. You had to bring in civil society organizations, the private sector. You had to bring in village groups. And it was only through a broad consultation that you would come up with strategies, plans, projects, programs that would address the issue in a way that was most likely to be effective, because the villagers themselves knew better than anyone else what their priority was for them and also what would work best in terms of addressing their priorities. So you can bring the rest of the world's knowledge and experience to bear. That's really valuable, but it does not substitute for the understanding that the local community has of its own needs and its own priorities.
Right. And so I feel like that conversation about increasing the space for local level decision making, I feel like that conversation is happening a lot more these days. Do you see that happening a lot more within these institutions, basically just thinking of ways to, as you said, you know, not just throw technical solutions, but kind of have these programs be, you know, combine the best of what the world can offer with the knowledge of local contexts?
I do see it happening more, but I also see more of a recognition of the limits of external support in influencing outcome. I think one of our lessons over the last 50, 60 years has to become progressively more humble about how much change you can bring about from the outside. And you see that in terms of the economic agenda, in terms of society, in terms of politics. Ultimately, change has to come from within society. The drivers of change have to come from within societies. What the rest of the world, what international institutions can do, is to support those people who want to bring about change, empower them through the knowledge, experience, and know-how of how what they're trying to achieve has worked in the rest of the world, get behind them sometimes with financing to help deliver the change that and the results that will sustain the momentum for change, but they cannot substitute themselves for the change drivers and policy makers from within countries. And I think that's something that as we recognize more and more of, we also have to recognize that this means that some parts of the world are ready for change. Some countries are ready for change at one time, and other countries, you know, there may not be the drivers for change. Then you have to find other things that you can do. But you cannot apply the same timetable and rhythm for change around the world because countries are at different points in terms of their own internal dynamics. And this is not a linear process. It's not like every year things get better. Sometimes people go through long periods when things are well, and then periods when things fall back. If you look at a country like Somalia, for example, why was it that for almost 25 years, Somalia lay in a state of relative anarchy with groups without really a strong central government? And then a situation came about a few years ago when there was enough momentum within the country with support from outside to bring about a federal government that was able to provide some degree, some modicum of a centralized functioning government structure. Why did it happen then rather than 10 years earlier, or why not 10 years later? It's very hard to be able to precisely predict exactly when things will develop and how they will develop in societies.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the specific case of Pakistan, in regards to their recent completion of an IMF program. So basically, you know, the program, as you know, I mean, was meant to strengthen Pakistan's foreign reserves just to keep their economy afloat in the near term. And so I think you also may have read some criticisms of the IMF program, you know, in an article in Business Recorder that, you know, there were a lot of issues it had, but I think overall the main problem was that to increase those foreign reserves, which Pakistan has increased substantially, Pakistan has had to take in a lot of debt. And dealing with that debt and, you know, paying off that debt will take away from the other issues that Pakistan needs to focus on in order to make the economy more resilient to external shocks in the future. So what do you make of those criticisms and how would you respond to them?
So first of all, I would recommend to your listeners to read a very nice piece that was done by Harold Finger, who's the mission chief for Pakistan, where he addressed a number of these issues in detail and kind of looked at and tried to respond to all of the points that have been raised, not just in that particular article, but more generally also a number of people have raised issues about how successful the last few years of efforts have been. I mean, it is a program that was a program developed by the Pakistani government, and the IMF's role has been to support it. And it's quite interesting to me that when I look at what was in the program, it was very much what was in the manifesto of the party that won power. You know, the PMLN, when it came to power, had already developed a program that they wanted to undertake. And if you look at that and map it against what the IMF was supporting, you'll find a very strong correlation. So I think one of the important things to recognize is that this actually predated any particular IMF support program they had. Second point is that when the IMF started this particular program in 2013, the economy was really very close to having a financial crisis. Reserves were coming down. They were well below the levels that you'd want to be comfortable. Fiscal deficit had gone up a lot. Growth had stalled. Confidence had gone down. And when I look back now, 3 years later, and say clearly Pakistan's in a much better shape in terms of the risk of immediate crisis. Budget deficit is considerably lower than it used to be. Tax revenues have gone up as a share of GDP by about 2.5 percentage points. You've seen also reserves go up, and I'll come to reserves in a moment. You've seen growth going up to close to 5% now. 5% growth is actually the highest pretty much in the whole of the Middle East and Central Asia, amongst all of the countries that I used to deal with until recently when I was at the IMF, of the 30 countries, Pakistan is at about the highest rate of growth now. So clearly something is going right. And I think it's important. And sometimes we don't do this enough in our own countries. We're always a little more critical than we are of others. When you look at it and you say, well, you have to recognize the things that have gone well. Now, one of the consequences, people say, well, what about reserves? Isn't this mainly financed by additional borrowing? Actually, that's not the case. If you look at the numbers, you'll see that even net reserves, which are the numbers that are net of all borrowing, have gone from being a negative 3 billion to a large positive number in the high single digits. So even net reserves have gone up beyond. What about the fact that if you look beyond that and say, well, you'll have to pay back this debt, is the debt a worrying number? Debt levels in Pakistan are now moderate, but external debt is still quite low compared to many other countries. So I don't see that as being the main worry for a country like Pakistan. You should always be careful. You should always look at how these numbers evolve, but that's not what I think should be the main worry. So what would you worry about? What is it that you would want to focus on? Well, I think what I would say is that the structural reform agenda, which this government started on and which was supported by the fund program, is still unfinished. There's more to be done. Privatization and restructuring of public enterprises, big part of the agenda. There's been some progress, but still a long way to go because there's still a drain on the budget. And when you keep spending a few billion dollars a year on supporting your large loss-making public enterprises, well, that's the money that you could be spending on education, on infrastructure, on health. And it's much more important to do that. So that's one area. Second area, which I do worry about, is that exports are really quite low in Pakistan. If you look at the level of exports, it's about 10% of the economy in terms of the exports share of GDP. Most emerging markets that are good, well-performing, highly rated, have exports that are almost four times as high in relation to their economy. That would mean that Pakistan's exports, instead of being in the $25 billion neighborhood, should be closer to $100 billion. Now, they're not going to get to $100 billion overnight, but certainly they should be moving up from $25 billion. In my view, you know, it's not unreasonable for us to aim for an export number of $50 billion in the next 3 to 5 years. Now, that is a little bit worrying because actually, if you look at exports now, they tend to be stagnating, even going down a little bit. So clearly there is a lot to be done. How will you do that? Well, energy is one issue. It's been a big problem in Pakistan. Hopefully that'll get resolved soon because there's been a lot of investment in bringing energy projects on stream. So that I hope will begin to show results next year. Security has been another concern. The business environment more generally is not as good as it should be. I mean, if you look at where we stack in terms of the Doing Business report, and all of these indicators, you know, have some problems, but they give you an overall measure. So you can do a lot better on that. I think competitiveness is another issue which we need to address. So exports I would really focus on as being an important thing to make growth sustainable. Exports are also important because it is through higher exports that we will pay off that increased external debt. It is through higher exports that we will pay for the increased imports of energy that we are now embarking upon through imports of LNG, etc. And it is through exports that we are going to be able to finance the imports that we need to generate higher living standards. So I would really focus on that.
Yeah. I mean, do you see good strategies in place to achieve those things? And, you know, like, because, for example, one thing on energy, I mean, it's not just about investment and increasing supply, but it's also about solving some of the systemic issues that prevent distribution companies right. from, you know, keeping the power on. So do you think there's a good strategy in place to solve a lot of those underlying issues? And do you think, you know, the multilaterals will have a role to play with those strategies?
So energy, I have seen, for example, now improvements in terms of the levels of losses, in terms of the collection of unpaid bills. You've seen improvements also in some of the management of the distribution companies. the plan to privatize distribution companies has not been taken off. It hasn't happened yet. And I think you have to decide as a country whether you want to privatize them or not. You can privatize them and make them run better, or you can run them better by having them run more commercially in the public sector. But in either event, they've got to become more commercial and run on a different basis. I think that the important point here is that energy, clearly there was a big shortage in terms of generation capacity, but also sometimes the generation capacity is not fully used because it's because loss making in some cases. So raising energy prices, but also bringing down energy costs is important. Because if you just keep raising prices to cover costs without asking yourself whether those costs are justified, then you're just getting the consumer to pay for inefficiency. And I think that's why it's important to work on both sides.
You know, there have been issues raised with the, you know, global development organizations in terms of, you know, despite their investment in economic growth, despite poverty reduction, you know, the really big issues of, say, you know, income inequality and, you know, environmental degradation, those have been sidelined and possibly made worse just in pursuit of growth. So what do you make of those criticisms, and, you know, how do you think these organizations are already or could do more to address them?
I think the first thing is that it's very hard to address issues of better access, better education, better environment without improving average incomes, which is just another way of saying growth. You know, growth is like butter. It makes everything go down a little easier. And so I don't at all apologize for the focus on growth. Now, having said that, you have to make sure that as you focus on growth, you focus on how that growth is generated in ways that respect the resource constraints of our planet, how that growth is organized in terms of allowing everybody to participate in the growth process and benefit from it. So it's inclusive in that sense. That's why there's a big focus on inclusive growth. And how the benefits of that growth are shared so that they're not just captured by a few, leaving many far behind. So I would say when the history of the world is written, the last 50 years, 60 years, will be seen as the period during which billions of people have seen improvements in their life values in terms of living standards, social indicators, education, health, life expectancy, which had not been seen for centuries before. So I think, you know, it's very easy for us to forget just what a transformative period the last 50, 70 years has been for so many people around the world. And in almost all parts of the world, people are much better off today than they were 70 years ago. Now, then this brings up new issues. Are we managing the improvement in living standards in a way that is consistent with the limits of sustainability on our planet? And clearly, there's a lot of areas where we can do better in doing that. How can the multilateral institutions help with that agenda? You know, should the World Bank, and the World Bank has a big program on trying to support climate change and other environmental issues. Forest, for example, is a big area. Similarly, others. And I would say this is going to be a big area of focus for the next thing. Inequality. Inequality has become a big issue, not just in poor countries, but in rich countries over the last 10, 20 years. What is driving inequality? Actually, it's technology, as I said earlier. It's some consequence of globalization. But I would also argue that it is public policy that has driven inequality. If you look at tax policy, spending policy, over the last two decades, you will find that there is a significant contribution of public policy to increasing inequality. So these were choices that societies have decided to make, and now they have to decide whether these choices need to be maintained or reversed or changed in some way. So I think those choices individual societies will need to make. The role of multilateral institutions in terms of how can they tackle inequality, well, I think it's mainly through ensuring that the people who have who at the moment don't have access to education, to capital, can be given that so that they can participate more effectively in the growth process. It's removing the barriers to inclusive growth that I think is the most useful contribution that international institutions can make. Multilateral organizations cannot, and I believe should not, be the place which makes choices on public policy that countries should make for themselves. So what is the degree of inequality that a country wants to have? What is the appropriate degree of inequality? What is it? That's a, each society will make a call. Now, I think it's a role of multilateral institutions to point out some of the consequences of it and to point out some of the trade-offs that are inherent in it. But I don't think that you can abrogate that choice from a country to an international institution, because ultimately I don't think they have the mandate to be able to make choices for that countries should legitimately and in a sovereign sense make for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Looking at multilaterals, what would you say, what would you identify as the biggest challenges for them in the future, and sort of what kind of organizational steps
right
they would need to take?
I think there are a number of challenges the multilateral institutions face. Let's talk about the multilateral development banks, for example. One is simply scale. If you look at the kinds of investment you need in infrastructure in the world, multilateral development banks provide a fraction of that. And they really need to be able to scale up. And how you scale up today in a world which is a different kind of financial markets than existed before is one big issue for them. Second big issue for multilateral institutions is how do they deal with global public goods? You talked about climate change. You can talk about disease. There are other areas. And I think these institutions have traditionally tended to work around countries and country-based program. Now, the more you look at global public goods, then it takes you away from a country focus to an issues focus. How you marry the two is always going to be a big challenge. And that's why, for example, you have the Global Fund for Malaria, Tuberculosis, and HIV. The Global Fund was set up as a way to tackle these three issues. Now, how do you marry that with the health sector strengthening and health sector development strategies that are being supported, say, by the World Bank or by the Regional Development Bank? That's been a challenge. I think going forward, that will be another challenge. A third big challenge is that the world itself is changing. The relative role of countries is changing. Developing countries account for the bulk of the growth in the world, and increasingly account for a bulk of the share of the global economy. Are they adequately represented in institutions that were set up after the Second World War, when the structure of the world was very different? Now, they have been changing. The relative shares have moved in favor of developing countries in many of these institutions to varying degrees. But still, I think that will be a challenge to keep adapting to it in a real sense. And then I would say a final challenge I think that these institutions will also face going forward is that our thinking has been organized around countries. Now, what about cities? Two-thirds of the world will be living in cities. Much of the growth in the population of the world will take place in cities in developing countries over the next 25 years. There will be nearly 24 cities in the world that will have 20 million people or so, or more at that time. And what happens in those cities and how they are managed will be as consequential for looking at how humanity as a whole is living as what is happening in 189 or 200 countries. So how do we think about engaging with cities? Now there is this, you know, there's the cities initiative that brings together the C40, the 40 mayors, chief executives of the 40 largest cities. But going beyond that, I think, how do multilateral organizations engage with cities, with subnationals, will be a big issue. And the final issue, I would say also, is that they have been in a world mainly of officials, governments, multilateral organizations whose members are governments. The boards are run by people who are appointed or elected by governments. Now you have foundations who are just as big, the Gates Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation. They're just as big players. Now you have the private philanthropy is a big area. You have the private sector is clearly driving a lot of the agenda. How do you, these institutions, the multilateral institutions, become part of a different mosaic of development actors, which includes not just the traditional, but the new players? And even in the traditional sphere, it's not just the institutions that were created 40 years ago, but some of the more recent ones, like the AIIB, which is the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or the BRICS Bank that's been created recently. How do you make sure that all of them equally feel ownership of the agenda and work together?
Now looking to, you know, your future with Center for Global Development, what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, you know, I have spent almost 40 years working in development support organizations in the World Bank, in the IMF, in DFID in the UK. And that's been a fantastic experience for me. Really, I couldn't have asked for a more rewarding set of things to work on than I've been able to do and have been fortunate enough to do. Now I want to move to a next phase where I want to look a little bit more at ideas and a bit less at the operation side. And what the Center for Global Development will allow me to do is to contribute to an organization that's really a fantastic organization. It's one of the best think tanks on development issues in the world. It was set up 15 years ago. And it has a particular focus, which attracts me a lot, because it looks not so much at giving advice, for example, to Kenya on how to do education, or to give advice to Pakistan on how to fix the banking sector. But rather, it looks at how can the support that the rest of the world has been providing Kenya to do education be made more effective. So it's looking at precisely the impact and effectiveness of development assistance and of other policies of the rich countries, of the international institutions, in support of development outcomes. And I think that would enable me to build on the experience that I've had in those organizations to now see how that work can be made more effective and more impactful. And if we can contribute to that, I think that would be a very satisfying and rewarding area to be involved with.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Ideas. Talking Ideas is produced by the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives, a Lahore-based research organization where I work as an advocacy and communications coordinator. The music on this episode was performed by Akmal Qadri. On the next episode, we talk to journalist and professor Raza Rumi on whether Pakistan's democracy will survive. Thanks for listening.